Guys, Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Judge Warky, Judge Larkin, the Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
All right, good morning. Please be seated. Welcome, everyone, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We've got six matters on our calendar today. The first three will be here for oral argument. Council, I'm sure, is familiar with our rules, and you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So with that, and I know you know the podium adjusts, so feel free to raise it up or down to your comfort. So with that, we'll begin. We'll call the first case on the calendar, A19-1898, State of Minnesota versus Aaron Michael Bergstrom. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed, and if you'd please both identify yourselves for our record as you begin, that would be helpful.
May it please the court, counsel for the state, my name is Robert M. Christensen. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Thank you for your time to hear our arguments this morning, and I was trying to think about how I wanted to begin our discussion this morning on this case, because I know that it's an uphill battle that we're fighting here. And so I don't want it lost that I'm somehow delusional that it isn't a severe uphill battle. But the way this appeal originated started at the actual sentencing hearing. There were at least a dozen people there in support of Mr. Bergstrom, including his parents, who are retired from North Dakota. And they just felt the proceeding was abrupt, that we weren't heard, and it was just the feeling, and obviously you weren't there.
Oh, so you're talking about the tone that was coming from the district judge as far as pronouncement of sentence.
Yes, I think that's a big part of the motivation.
Since all of us, the panel judges, have come from the district court, I can understand the party's frustration when you feel like you're not getting heard. But ultimately, as you said in your opening statement, you got a huge uphill fight on this. And I'm looking for some basis or explanation that would cause us to reverse in order to have a deviation.
Yes, and that leads me to the point I want to make about that. And in reading the respondent's brief, well done, he's pointing to, is this the rare case? That's the word that I think comes through loud and clear, rare. What's rare about Mr. Bergstrom's case, or so rare that he should be given the treatment of a downward departure? And I think the most rare fact was something that I did discuss in the transcript on A6, and I was thinking about it in terms of sobriety, the 12-step program, and you know, they pointed out that he admitted, so it'd been 8 years since his prior offense, and I think that's a mitigating factor right there, that he did go through a prior felony sentence. He went through Hennepin County's DWI intensive specialized court, completed it, and during his probation interview for the PSI, he admits on his own that he was able to drink during that intensive supervision program. And I'm sure that is not something anyone in Hennepin County enjoyed hearing about. However, when I thought about it, I go, wow, that's a negative. And I mentioned that during the sentencing hearing. And I went, you know, the more I thought about it, I have a father who's a recovering alcoholic, former physician, been sober for 40 years. And it's all about admitting your mistakes and coming clean. And when you look at Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, who started AA, that's what they talk about, an absolute honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, a moral inventory of our own behaviors and how it may have impacted other people. And here he comes in and he hits step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of himself. Yeah, I cheated this system 8 years ago. Got away with it.
But we're still stuck. I don't want to say stuck because one of our panel members is on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, but we're prescribed in terms of what is fair and just so that we're not treating people differently, whether they adopt the principles of AA or not. You know, one of your arguments that you raised has to do with Mr. Bergstrom's age, and quite frankly, I'd like to say that the older we get, the more we understand the importance of sobriety when there's an issue and that it would give us insight into succeeding in a rehabilitation program. But unless you can tell me, I don't see how this is anything more than an unsubstantiated assertion. I don't know of any state, any case studies or any programs that would necessarily bear that out.
Bear which out?
That age is a reason for a deviation, that you're more likely to succeed.
I think someone who's older is, as you stated, more likely to succeed because they have more wisdom and life experience. And, you know, relapse is part of recovery for many addicts. He relapsed, and he learned from it, and he took responsibility for it. And I think it's all the factors. I think that was the other lasting impression by the family members was it's like he did everything he possibly could to rehabilitate himself prior to the sentencing hearing. He enrolled in a treatment program and completed it, an intensive treatment program. He was hooked up on ignition interlock. He was already hooked up on it. He was in a healthy relationship. He was employed. He has a college degree. He admitted his mistakes. It's just he hit every single thing that we want him to do. And then he came on top of that, I guess. It's all of these factors. And he counsel for the state sort of does, you know, a litany of factors. But that was the point. He's done everything. I don't know who else would qualify.
But doesn't it beg the question, though, Mr. Christensen, that why did it take a second felony DWI and a fourth DWI overall to come to that realization? And I'll be the first to admit, I mean, I was a former drug court judge. I was a former DWI court judge. I truly believe that anybody can change at any time. And maybe Mr. Bergstrom has made that change in his life. But when it takes a subsequent criminal intervention, like a second felony DWI, to bring that on, I think that weighs against some of those other factors that change, you know. And in looking at this case, and of course from our appellate perspective, the issue is, like you have identified, you know, is this the rare case? And really, I think we need to look at that in terms of the standard of review here. So the judge found, perhaps in a dismissive fashion or not, we weren't there obviously, but in any event, he found that Mr. Bergstrom's continued behavior of driving under the influence is a danger to public safety and that therefore this isn't the rare case. How is that finding by the court, as demonstrated by the history here, an abuse of discretion? I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
I think for me, the 8 years.
Okay.
Right? It's not that he just, you know, continued on here. He went 8 years of being sober. I'm not sure that he wasn't sober for a good period of time. He did get into a dysfunctional relationship with a female that I think triggered this. I think what he has learned is that, you know, we're all going to have triggers in our life. Triggers aren't going to go away.
Right.
And it's how we adapt and cope with all of that. It's a struggle for every human being on the planet. But I feel because of how he presented himself that he did show that this is a guy we shouldn't waste $80,000 a year on, that because of his education, because of his age, because of all the actions that he took to rehabilitate himself, that made him the rare case. And you see disparities in articles in the newspapers of people arrested and they're on their 20th one and they haven't been to prison. And that's what you get from the family members too. Like, well, wait a minute. And I understand there is discretion and that's going to happen in our system as it is. But I think that's also what motivates this as well. The other thing that I found, a letter to the editor about our treatment model is broken, and it was an interesting point, I'd like to bring it up here, is that we talk about how, she said, what other disease is there on the planet where we punish people for worsening symptoms? You know, you get cancer, the treatment doesn't work, you start to do worse, we treat you. We have more empathy, we have more compassion. And it is maybe a catch-22 in that regard of how we approach this problem. And so with that in mind, that relapse is part of recovery, and, you know, he went 8 years without an offense. That's exactly what the laws are there to do. At the end of the day, the criminal laws aren't there to protect people from themselves necessarily as it is to protect the public. That's the reason why DWI is there. I mean, you know, if someone wants to drink themselves to death every night in their own home, I guess that's their prerogative. And so he went 8 years, and I think that makes it rare. And there was a triggering event, and I think he learned from it, and he took himself on in a new way and presented himself in that rare new way. So I think that is the rare fact to address your question again, just a long answer for what really requires a short answer. He went 8 years. He can do this. And, yeah, you had a little bit of a relapse, and, yeah, you got busted. But look at what you've done, and this let's support you in that. We can still punish him. He can still do a year in the county jail. You know, one of the things that has a – and that's why it's like, why this guy? So on my file here, one of the things I'm doing for him is filing bankruptcy on his student loans while he's in prison, if we can get him dismissed because there's a motion there. So it does have other economic impacts, and it's like, okay, you know, who are we sending to prison? Is this really the right guy to send to prison, or can we punish him in the county jail? They could have given him a year in the county jail, and I still think that's what he should have. He had a job. He was in a good relationship. He had support of family and friends. He's a perfect candidate. You go to prison, I don't know what they're treating there. It can be dangerous in prison. He's a slight guy. I just don't know if he's going to come out better after 2 years of an institution or if he were to continue on with monitoring and with empathy rather than shame. So I think we need to look at this differently. I think Mr. Bergstrom hits all the categories that we would want someone to be behaving. He's got the tools, the intelligence, and the family support to back him up. And he could still be punished, and that makes him the rare case. I'll yield the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The outcome of this appeal really is driven by the standard of review. The district court here exercised its discretion and imposed a sentence within the presumptive range. The district court even gave low end of the box on the presumptive range, giving him credit for his honesty at sentencing and with probation. The court here had all the information before it. It read all of the letters and ultimately exercise its discretion. I'm not unsympathetic to Mr. Bergstrom. I hope he stays sober, but the fact that a mitigating factor might be present does not mean this court should reverse the district court's exercise of its discretion. And I will rest on my briefs unless the court has any questions.
Questions?
Nope.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Anything further, Mr. Christensen?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for the
opportunity. All right. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your briefing in the matter and understand your positions, and we'll issue a decision within 90 days. The matter is taken under advisement.